Today's Thursday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, George Floyd has been laid to rest, but the demands for racial equality inspired by his tragic death continue.
Everything will go towards preserving this moment in history somewhere in the area.
Dozens of states in the U.S. are seeing a rise in coronavirus cases as more businesses reopen.
You still have to practice a degree of caution.
Also ahead, did Burundi's president die from a heart attack, or could it have been the coronavirus? It's all on today's International Edition. Wednesday marked the 16th day of demonstrations across the United States as protesters continue to demand racial justice. In Washington, D.C., workers started to take down the temporary fencing around the White House that became covered with signs, notes, photos, and cries for change. Activists there say they didn't want those messages to disappear.
Everything will go towards preserving this moment in history somewhere in the area.
They spent the night carefully relocating signs and notes across the street to a covered walkway. I spoke to one activist who, along with a group of others, had been given permission to set up at St. John's Church, across from the White House, where President Trump's recent visit and the violent removal of protesters created further outrage. She talked about the need to preserve the messages as an important moment in American history.
My name is Davida. I'm part of a group of friends from the community that didn't like what was happening. We started coming out almost 2 weeks ago with just backpacks of first aid supplies to help people with tear gas and rubber bullets. We brought out cases of water to make sure people stayed hydrated and we could wash people's faces. And then it kind of graduated. We started receiving a lot of donations, a lot of help for what we're doing because we're coming out daily. So it just, and people coming and donating their time with us. So we kind of just grew into this collective. We hand out free waters, free food, you know, snacks. We have first aid supplies. We have masks, hand sanitizer. I mean, we get food deliveries daily from people. We hand out sandwiches, stuff like that, stuff for the kids. We'll get popsicle runs brought in where we'll hand out popsicles to all the people when they come back from marching. We're just trying to give back and support this community as much as humanly possible. We've been staying here 24 hours, you know. We are here all the time. We have permission from the church. Church knows we're here, loves what we're doing, has given us permission to stay here. We'll be re-landscaping when we're done. So we found out last night that the fence was being torn down today, and we thought it'd be wrong for them to tear down all of the protest signs and the artwork and the pleas and begs and demands of people here that need to be heard. And we knew that if they tore down the fence and threw everything away, and then just had bike rack with police there, people will come here and be upset. And we were worried of what, you know, what agenda they were having with what they were doing. So we wanted to ensure that people's, you know, artwork, their voices, everything that is about this movement right now is not being silenced.
So all a group of you went to the trouble to take everything down carefully and relocate it?
It was kind of a collective of everyone that was here at the moment. When we found out about it, there was still a crowd here, maybe 30 people, 40 people. We let everyone know what was going on and told them, you know, if there was any that they wanted to save for their own memorial or their own, they should go grab it. And asked everyone if they could help us with a plan in relocating everything so that they could take it and that people could still come down here and see their voices and be, you know, be heard and not be silenced. Because we're all, you know, sick of it. It's time for change.
You relocated a lot of the signs, and I understand there have also been some museums and others that have come by. What are they? Are they looking to put some of that in safekeeping?
So while we were putting things up, a lot of the societies around here came by actually showing up doing the same thing we were doing. They were afraid of what was going to be lost, and they came to save it. And then they realized we already had taken it all down and requested that they could take some. A few of the organizations have already gathered what they wanted and taken a few things. We've also promised that we will do our best to preserve whatever we can to make sure whatever is left behind when, you know, this movement moves out of this area
to make sure that all of this history stays preserved.
Can you name some of the...
So the D.C. Art Society came by, the Smithsonian came by, the African American History Museum came by, University of Maryland came by, and I believe a few others that some other people here dealt with as well that I wasn't aware of have also stopped by. I'm not sure which ones have already grabbed what they wanted. We do have some that we're already keeping that were put aside by people to go to certain places. So everything's being as preserved as it possibly can, and everything will go towards preserving this moment in history somewhere in the area.
That was Washington, D.C. activist Savita. Since the May 25th death of African-American George Floyd while in police custody, Americans have been protesting in the streets and demanding police reform nationwide. One movement garnering a lot of attention has been the call to defund police. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Dr. David Thomas, a forensic studies professor at Florida Gulf Coast University via Skype. Dr. Thomas is an expert in policing in America and a veteran police officer specializing in mental health, police, and minority relations. Steve begins by asking what Thomas thinks should be the role of police in American society.
The role here in America is a very diverse role. When I started, all it was in 1978, the job was people violated the law. It was take and put those violators in jail. It evolved, and I can tell you because I started in 78 and I retired in 1998. So I've kind of gone through each one of these decades with this understanding. And somewhere in the 80s, when they let everybody out of the mental institutions and they just turn them loose on the streets, we all of a sudden became health workers with no training. Today, there's some training, but there's no training. And we are responsible for making an assessment of somebody if they're a threat to themselves or somebody else, and then transporting them. The 90s was going on. We still were doing the same thing, but we got better educated. You know, policing now, you know, CIT, which is officers are trained to be able to respond and deal with critical people who are in mental health crisis and have those conversations with them. After 9/11, the mission changed. Oh, let's go back. We had community policing. It afforded us an opportunity to get out of patrol cars. It was funded by the federal government where agencies could actually write grants. And then as a result of those grants, you had people that were assigned to do nothing but community police.
So given your expertise, given your experience, you know, what should the job, in your opinion, be?
It has to be a little bit of all, because there's one other thing that I got to kind of throw into this pot. 9/11 changed everything. The police mission changed from being, you know, like agencies wanting to be in partnership with their communities to actually having a responsibility to responding to terrorism. And so that meant that all the money that went in community policing that came from the federal government, it went into those efforts. The way I look at policing today, it should be a mixture of all of those things.
So I want to ask you this. So, you know, a lot of protest time is given to this notion of the chant, defund the police. Some rephrase it as reimagining of police forces, looking at municipalities, redistributing the funds. So, you know, with this topic in mind, where do you respond to those kinds of discussions?
When they talked about defunding, when the first one I heard of defunding, and I have several friends that are chiefs, and you can only imagine my phone just blew up. What are they talking about? They're crazy, you know. And I'm sitting here thinking, because we physically could not reimagine that what would happen if you said, okay, defunding to us means that you want to do away with us. We have dismantled one department in New Jersey. And that department rebuilt itself, Camden, New Jersey. And they did that with the idea that they could get, if they dismantled it and reorganized it, then what would happen is they could get rid of all the bad officers that had been protected by the union and a bunch of other things, and you had to reapply. New rookies coming in, they got to get out, they got to go walk on foot and knock on doors and go talk to people, they got to work a community. So when we talk about defunding, So I'm in one sense I'm adamantly opposed, but here's the rub. As I look and do research, I recognize that there are agencies that have mental health clinicians that are a part of their system and actually respond to calls. I foresee that as being the change. and a much needed change. Money is always going to be the issue.
So without consent decrees, without learning the lessons from the 1960s, the 1990s with Rodney King, the current issues with minority relations, you may not have the solution, but what is your best guess for moving forward?
I think you can't leave local problems to be local problems. So the greatest way to handle this issue would probably be state oversight, to create something just like the Justice Department did when they had consent decrees, to be able to have independent people come in, do the investigation, look at the data sets and say, okay, this is what has to happen. And the state actually takes those agencies to court and hold them, and they can do the same thing and hold them accountable through some sort of decree that is done at the state level. Then you don't need the whole outside thing from the federal government. The other side of that is, if agencies are smart at this point, what they should be doing is reaching out to the community and having those conversations. And I don't mean the chiefs of police, because the chief sees it one way, and they have this the way they want their department to run. But the line guys, like I used to be, they need to be sitting in those meetings and having those conversations with people to understand what the people feel and what they see.
Dr. David Thomas, forensic studies professor at Florida Gulf Coast University, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. The issue of police reform is also being discussed in Congress. One day after George Floyd was buried, one of his brothers came to Washington to take action. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the story.
Philanese Floyd says he's tired of the pain after people are killed during interactions with police.
I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Stop the pain.
He tells the House Judiciary Committee his brother needs to be more than another face on a T-shirt, another name on a growing list.
The people marching in the streets are telling you enough is enough.
Chairman Jerry Nadler's hearing is the first after Democrats introduced a broad police reform and accountability package.
Today, we answer their call.
Republicans are working on their own proposals, even as President Trump squarely sides with law enforcement. Sagar Magani, Washington.
As a possible gesture of racial reconciliation, there have been calls for taking down Confederate flags and renaming 10 U.S. military bases named for Confederate leaders who fought to continue slavery in the 1860 Civil War. But White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany Wednesday read a statement from President Trump, who dismissed the request.
My administration will not even consider the renaming of these magnificent and fabled military installations. Our history as the greatest nation in the world will not be tampered with. Respect our military.
President Trump in recent days has again taken to Twitter in posts that appear aimed at stoking division and glorifying police violence. White House correspondent Patsy Wittakuswara looks at how the president's combative approach might fare at a time when there is remarkable national outpouring of empathy for the African American community.
Video of a 75-year-old man shoved by police in Buffalo, New York, went viral last week. The two officers involved have been charged with second-degree assault. But President Donald Trump reignited the controversy Tuesday, tweeting a video by a right-wing outlet presenting an unproven conspiracy theory that the man was trying to block police communication equipment. Trump accused him of being an Antifa provocateur, saying he fell harder than was pushed. Trump's tweet is the latest of a series of remarks that have stoked anger and racial division in a nation shaken with more than 2 weeks of unrest over the death of George Floyd, a black man who died after being in the custody of a white police officer. Norman Ornstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
This is not a president who is capable of looking at turmoil in the country and trying to find ways to heal wounds and bring people more broadly together. His success, as he has seen it, is built on attacking even more harshly anybody who's critical of him and at trying to stoke divisions and excite his own narrower base.
a base that may be getting even more narrow. Recent polls show 76% of Americans, including 71% of whites, call racism and discrimination a big problem in the U.S. compared to 50% in 2015. Jonathan Metzl is a sociology professor at Vanderbilt University, author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland.
A lot of white Americans are waking up to the reality that they were part of a system that maybe privileged them, but that has some pretty horrible implications for social justice and for everyone else.
A survey also shows that 78% of Americans support the protests and 57% believe police officers are more likely to treat Black people unfairly. This shift in attitudes has contributed to change on the ground. Some mayors have agreed to redirect police funds towards social services, an idea perceived as radical just a few years ago. But meeting with law enforcement officials Monday, Trump rejected calls to defund the police and the notion of institutionalized racism in law enforcement.
Sometimes you'll see some horrible things like we witnessed recently, but 99.9, but let's go with 99% of them are great, great people.
The White House press secretary says Trump is combating racism by ensuring economic opportunity for Black Americans and pushing for criminal justice reform. The president has spoken to George Floyd's family on the phone, but has not met with Black community representatives or protesters. His election rival Joe Biden has met with Floyd's family and Black leaders. While polls show Americans view Biden as more empathetic than Trump, the Democratic presidential nominee has his own challenges. Again, Norm Ornstein of AEI.
He's going to have to walk a fine line, getting support, as he has in the past, from law enforcement officials, while also making the strong call for dramatic transformation in how we deal with police and police violence in the country.
Biden has denounced rioting and also rejected calls to defund the police. He is focusing on police reforms and has pledged action to reverse systemic racism. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
The massive demonstrations over the death of George Floyd have resonated far beyond U.S. borders. The outrage over racial inequality is hitting a nerve in Europe, where young people there are seeing parallels and finding inspiration. Joining us from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, demonstrations there are continuing, seem to be growing, and it sounds like some leaders there are also watching pretty closely.
Indeed. French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe was fairly blunt when he put out a statement that was then released on Twitter, saying that the emotions felt around the world following the death of a man in what he called unacceptable, monstrous conditions back on the 25th of May in Minneapolis. These emotions were shared by all French people. And it's quite extraordinary for a French politician, someone as senior as a prime minister, to actually come out with a public statement about another country, particularly a country that is traditionally so close to France diplomatically. Also, the fact that that tweet was retweeted by the French ambassador to Washington. That ambassador is a close political ally of President Macron, the French president. Indeed, he was his former foreign policy advisor. So I think we're seeing there not just French political class agreeing that, yes, what is happening on the Black Lives Matter movement is important for society at the moment, but also seeing, I think, an undercurrent that the French political class are wanting to distance themselves somewhat from the American president, Donald Trump.
And I understand that the protests are continuing there as well.
They are. They're now getting into very much a rhythm of each Tuesday and each Saturday at Place de la République. What you have to remember is these marches aren't just for George Floyd. These are also marches really about a young man who was died in mysterious circumstances while in police custody. They were immigrants to France from Haiti. And there are questions around this, just as there are questions around police and the way police have been targeting youths in France, particularly youths in these suburbs, these poorer suburbs. And I think a lot of this also comes out of the lockdown that we've had because of COVID. There was a lot of allegation that there was heavy policing during the lockdown, particularly in those suburbs. And there were some times when tensions flared. But again, we're going back to this simple question of questions around police violence, questions about social injustice, and really just the outrage of a new generation that wants to see change and wants to see change happening much quicker than some of the older generation who are in power at the moment.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, thank you so much. Washington, D.C. Wednesday urged people who had participated in protests against police brutality and racism to get tested for coronavirus. The city is reporting that members of the D.C. National Guard have been tested positive for the virus. Chief U.S. infectious disease physician Dr. Anthony Fauci, in an interview with ABC's Good Morning America, said he's not surprised.
When you open, that doesn't mean that everything is okay and you just can just do whatever you want. You still have to practice a degree of caution.
In that same interview, Fauci said that as businesses begin to reopen, people should be careful and not conduct business as usual. The number of U.S. coronavirus cases hit 2 million as 19 states continue to see their numbers rise. Nonetheless, President Trump, who has been slipping in the polls recently as he fights for a second term, says he's planning to return to holding campaign rallies next week.
In the state of Oklahoma, we're going to be coming into Florida, do a big one in Florida, big one in Texas. They're all going to be big. We're going to Arizona. We're going to North Carolina at the appropriate time.
Coronavirus cases and hospitalizations have been spiking in parts of California and the U.S. Southwest. The uptick in cases could lead authorities to reimpose restrictions that would further complicate efforts to reopen the U.S. economy, which has been devastated by the lockdowns. The sudden death of outgoing Burundian President Nkurunziza Tuesday came as a shock to everyone on the African political scene. He ruled Burundi with an iron fist for 15 years, including a controversial third term that saw hundreds killed in protests and more than 500,000 fleeing the country. Some expect nothing will change on how the East African nation handles its governance. Mohamed Youssef reports.
Burundi has begun 7 days of mourning after the death of President Pierre Nkurunziza, who died Monday at a hospital in the town of Karuzi. The government said Nkurunziza died from cardiac arrest, but there is speculation the cause may have been COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. Local media reported the late president's wife was flown to a Nairobi hospital last week after contracting the virus. Nkurunziza was due to step down in August and hand power to the winner of last month's election, retired Army General Evariste Ndayishimiye. Domitien Ndayizeye handed power to Nkurunziza in 2005 at the end of Burundi's civil war. He says the main task given to Nkurunziza was to implement a political agreement between the Hutu majority and Tutsi minority.
When he came to power, we have just finished to agree about the Arusha agreement. It has been agreed that he will follow to implement this Arusha agreement. He has done his best. Maybe there has been some issues on which he has not been able to reach, and I think the next president will go on.
The agreement signed in Tanzania ended a civil war that claimed the lives of more than 300,000 people. Some opposition politicians accused the late president of violating the constitution when he ran for a third term in 2015. His government was also accused of unleashing the ruling party youth wing, known as Imbonerakure, on its opponents. Lewis Maj is a Burundi researcher with Human Rights Watch.
Most of my time I was documenting abuse committed by the Imbonerakure, which were the youth militia aligned with the ruling CNDD-FDD party. And many of these crimes were happening sort of almost hidden, if you will. But really what we're seeing post-2015 is Nkurunziza giving the green light for these Imbonerakure, these youth militias, we see them really become used as the enforcers across the country. The rise of the Imbonerakure will be Nkurunziza's defining characteristic of his human rights record.
In 2017, Burundi became the first country to withdraw from the International Criminal Court after being accused of committing crimes against humanity. Burundi also closed offices of the United Nations on Human Rights and, in May, expelled officials from the World Health Organization. Last week, four journalists were imprisoned to terms of 2.5 years for investigating political unrest in the west of the country. Marge says the human rights situation may not improve with the passing of Nkurunziza.
I don't think we're going to see much change with the death of Nkurunziza with regards to human rights standards. It went beyond just one individual. So I think we're unfortunately looking at dark days ahead.
Naleke van der Waal, Deputy Director for Central Africa at the International Crisis Group, says the future of Burundi depends on what the political system left behind by Nkurunziza will do in the coming months.
He was expected to remain influential because he was appointed Supreme Guide of Patriotism. So it was likely that he continued to play a role on the political scene in Burundi. So with his death, it is possible that Evariste has more freedom of movement to act more independently. But then again, Nkurunziza is only one man, and his rule was underpinned by a political system. And that system is still very much in place.
For now, the Speaker of Parliament will be in charge of the affairs of the state until the President-elect is sworn in on August 20th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. Brazil's most populous state, Sao Paulo, reported a record number of COVID-19 deaths for a second day in a row on Wednesday, even as the city allowed shops to resume business and prepared to reopen its malls. Sao Paulo, the epicenter of the pandemic in Brazil, recorded 340 new deaths within 24 hours, moving the state's confirmed death toll close to 10,000. Iran says it has told the UN's aviation agency that it will send the black boxes from a downed Ukrainian jetliner that was heading to Paris for analysis once countries involved in the investigation agree. The other countries include Ukraine, Canada, and the United States. Canada had previously pressed Iran to send the black boxes to France for analysis. A book by former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton will be published on June 23rd. Despite attempts by White House lawyers to block its release, the book is said to provide details about Bolton's time as a top aide to President Trump, who abruptly fired him last September amid disagreements over how to handle foreign policy challenges such as North Korea, Iran, Afghanistan, and Russia. And finally, today, in the wake of George Floyd's death, entertainment companies are rethinking what is acceptable for public viewing. One example is the reality show Cops, widely known for its reggae theme song Bad Boys. The show allowed viewers to ride along with police officers on patrol in various cities. Cops aired for 33 seasons. But in May, the Paramount Network temporarily pulled the show off air and now says the decision is permanent. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases?
Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.